Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And I'm sad, Cindy.
Why is that, Tony?
I don't have any burgundy in my glass.
Well, we don't have a glass either.
No, we don't. we didn't plan this very well.
Yeah, well, that's okay. So one of the questions is understanding how to read a wine label. You touched on it a little bit. Can you talk about it a little bit in depth?
Well, a lot of times, U.S. wine drinkers, that you learn grapes first. You learn Cabernet Sauvignon or Pinot Noir. That's why Burgundy in particular is a weird region for people because, well, the grapes are really simple, but the wines are very complicated because you have to sort out. You have things on different quality levels. You know, you have things that are just called Bourgogne, which is just Burgundy, and there's white and there's red, and they're made from Chardonnay for the white and Pinot Noir for the red. And you have things that are village level, village, AOC, village level, and that's the name of the village. So some famous ones might be Volnay or Beaune or less famous, Ladois, Pernin Vergelès. Merceau is a famous white wine, and also a little bit of red wine there. And then you have Premier Cru, and that'll usually say on the label, you know, below the Volnay, it'll say, you know, Premier Cru Pitur or Frémier or something. No, I didn't cough. That's actually how you say it. And then some villages have what's considered a Grand Cru or one of the best handful of sites. And these are wines that when you go from a village level to a Premier Cru, you're going from something that is meant to be representative of the vineyard is good enough to produce wine that's representative of a style that is considered typical and sort of first class for that village. So for Volnay. And Volnay Premier Cru are one of the best, you know, say seven sites or seven vineyard areas that are all a little bit distinct from each other in their aspect and the styles of wines that they produce. And it's very interesting to compare those to each other. And Volnay is one of those villages that doesn't have a Grand Cru. It doesn't have that next level. And that next level, the difference between village and the Premier Cru is usually the finesse of the tannins, the ripeness of the fruit. So there's a certain sweetness and a certain finesse that's inherently there when you go from village to Premier Cru. Usually expect the village stuff to be flavorful, gutsy, and very, you know, very tasty, but maybe not that refined. Some villages have a Grand Cru, so or more than one Grand Cru. Gevrey-Chambertin is a village that has seven Grand Crus.
Who decides if it's a Grand Cru?
Most of these things were decided years and years ago, mostly in the 30s, which is funny. It's a decade of a lousy vintages for the most part in most of France, although in Burgundy, 34 and 37 were pretty decent, or pretty strong, actually, for 37. The Grand Crus were decided by councils at that time. Each there's sort of like a council for the village that decides what's included in the village and what's not included in the village. And these are towns of 200 people or something,
yeah.
You know, that have like six famous old growers, and they sit and essentially, you know, some of them retired, some of them active, and they sit and decide, you know, what's going to be just Bourgogne, what's going to be say Gevrey-Chambertin, and what's going to be notable enough to be its own Premier Cru. And a lot of this, like I said, happened in the 30s. And what's notable enough to be considered a Grand Cru? Usually the Grand Cru vineyards are the first ones planted, and they're the ones that historically the towns take their names from. So, for example, Chambertin, the wine that was famously Napoleon's favorite wine, that's a wine that was the first planted in that village. And then the vineyards around it, the other Grand Crus, were next. And then they start coming down the hill to a little bit lesser sites that don't ripen as nicely. I mean, it makes sense. It's mm-hmm. the easiest place to grow something beautiful. That's where you're going to plant it first, right?
Sure.
And then it kind of branches out from there. So as it goes down the hill and sort of across the road,
yeah.
the level of the wine goes down. If you go too high on the hill, it doesn't ripen up enough. And Burgundy is essentially one giant slope, the Côte d'Or, the Golden Slope. And there's that sweet spot on the slope. And if there's enough angle and exposure and the soil is interesting in that spot, then that's where all the Grand Crus are kind of located in a big stream as you go down the long hill of the Côte d'Or.
What are some of the best years and maybe some of your favorite producers?
Well, the thing to think about for someone right now is what vintages are available on the market. Things to know. 13 is going to be horrible. Most of France had a very tough vintage in 13. So if you're planning for your cellar, don't plan to put a lot of them in there.
Okay.
12, it's a very particular time as far as buying Burgundy. 12 is a very strong vintage, especially for reds, but a very, very short crop, which will mean they'll be expensive and they'll be hard to find. 11 is a very mixed vintage, and that it, when I say mixed, I mean like a, it varies from like a solid B to like C minus for the quality of some of the stuff, and you got to be very selective with the 11s, and they're not going to live that long. It's not really rich material for aging, even in the best sites. But because the wines are scarce, the prices are still high. 10, the vintage before, is a spectacular vintage, maybe the most complete vintage for whites and reds, for short term, for modest wines to Grand Crus for ageability, maybe since the 70s, maybe since 78 or something. Pretty remarkable quality vintage. The crop is a little short. There's still some available in the marketplace. Most of the very famous guys, a lot of the sort of geeks or the real collectors, they scoop them up before they ever get released. They get themselves in line for them. That does not mean there's not excellent wine to be bought. 9, the vintage before, that is a super useful vintage. 9 is a vintage that it was a warm year. The acidity is a little bit lower. The fruit is inherently a little bit sweeter. The structure is a little more diffuse. It makes it easier to consume as a young wine. It's not as much tannin for the reds. They're a little bit lighter on the whites. The white quality is not up to the red quality in 9. But 9 is, for the most part, if you're in restaurants and you're looking for red Burgundy, 9 is exactly a vintage to go for. Easy to consume. There are not a lot of mistakes. The high notes for aging a long time are not that high. But for relatively early consumption and pleasure, terrific vintage.
What about 2010 as far as aging, if you're trying to keep wine in your cellar?
I would say that if you're trying to keep the village level wines, will certainly age 5, 10 years. The Premier Crus, for the most part, 10, 15, 18, depending upon the Premier Cru, they're pretty variable. Some sites are really spectacular. Going back to the thing about rating the vineyards, they've not been changed since the 30s. And there was a lot of politics in the initial ratings. Like I said, there's 7 Grand Crus and Gervais Chambertin. There probably should be 3. Mm-hmm. You know, Louis Saint-Georges has no Grand Crus. There probably should be at least 1 Les Saint-Georges.
Okay.
So a lot of times, and Von Romanée has a bunch of Grand Crus, but really could probably have another 3, especially one particular, the Premier Cru, and, you know, and Chambon-Moussigny, same thing. I often look for vineyards that are Premier Crus that should be Grand Crus. To buy.
Sure.
Louis Saint-Georges, Les Saint-Georges, 2010, if you can find them, or the other one that I think should be Grand Cru, Les Cailles, the quail. You're talking about quail.
Yeah, okay.
Those two vineyards, and if you find 2010s from good producers, like Ligier Belair is a great producer of both wines from those sites. I would look for those in a second.
Do you know about the history of Clos de Vougeot, as it was a monastery at one point? I think, I mean, it's such an interesting place to, and you can walk in there, talk about, you know, what can people do when they're traveling.
Burgundy owes its wine growing history and abilities to the monks. I mean, all of the techniques in Burgundy were developed in monasteries, and Clos de Vougeot is where an awful lot of, Clos de Vougeot's vineyard is a Grand Cru that's owned by 63 different growers that at one time was owned by the church. And for about 500 years, I think the church produced wine for a long time from Gamay that was quite horrible, and then from Pinot Noir that's remarkable on that side.
And I mean, that's one of my favorite houses for sure. And they actually, when you go there, they have a shop, and they also have some of the really, really old, ancient winemaking tools there, don't they?
But
so it's a pretty cool place to go.
That's remarkable to see.
Traveling.
Let's give people a couple of quick travel notes and restaurant notes if they're traveling to Burgundy. Hopefully this has piqued their interest a little bit. So let's talk for a second about restaurants in the region that you like to get to. I know you smile first and foremost when there's going to be good food on the table. So whose table do you want to be sitting at?
Well, Paul Bocuse for sure. And, you know, as
Paul Bocuse is still alive.
I was going to say, as the gentleman gets older.
Years old now.
Yes. And I was there, I guess, about a year ago and had the opportunity to meet his wife, who was, you know, kind of walking around the restaurant and still had her hands in it. And she's definitely in her 90s, and this tiny, petite, amazing woman. And the restaurant is beautiful and very old world and feels just amazing. And they do a lot of many, many classic, obviously, dishes that were classic before his time and classic that he has made classic.
And the things he updated in the 60s and 70s that are remarkable renditions of different dishes. A favorite thing that you ate there?
The the chicken with the morels is just really brilliant. And this would be a good time of the year to go there and get that because it's springtime. So if anyone is actually on their way to France,
time for morels.
I would go there. I'd run quickly to go there and eat. But, you know, there are many dishes. He does quenelle de brochette as well, and that's just a brilliantly executed dish. And I'm sure he has asparagus on right now. And white asparagus is actually really highly coveted in that region. So, you know, I'm sure that's probably out or done by now, but a beautiful spring item. And you know, I love the restaurants in Beaune. I just love being
in Beaune. One of my favorite
Beaune.
Casual restaurants in the world. Well, I say casual. They're relaxed.
It's because you can go in there in your blue jeans. But it's a very, very
Pierre
good restaurant.
Pierre and Fabrice are in their blue jeans. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's mm-hmm. this is a couple that has a little restaurant that does a handful of dishes on a daily basis, a few that are just superb. I mean, they get great simple product, and Fabrice is did not go to school for culinary. She's just a terrific cook. And
right.
The pigeon there.
Yeah, it's one of the best things I've ever
pigeon
eaten.
With spices is one of the best things in the
Absolutely.
World. She gets these beautiful pigeons that I think are a bit overfed at the end of their time before they're harvested. There's always a little extra fat underneath the skin on those
they're
birds.
They're so good.
And Pierre has this fantastic cellar and will absolutely tell you the truth about everything that's in it.
Mm-hmm.
And his advice is one of maybe three people that keep restaurant cellars that I can think of in the world that I actually will... You know what? I know they're going to be right on it. I know mm-hmm. that they're going to tell me the truth about things. And
he has she has a sweetbread dish that you like there.
Oh,
I think, as well,
that's a terrine. She makes in summertime a foie gras and sweetbread terrine that is just completely remarkable.
Sounds really good.
He also has this huge collection. It's funny to be in Burgundy, and he has this huge collection of sauterne. And I know it's because his wife makes this ridiculous dessert. She makes this burnt almond tart that sells out almost immediately. It's one of those things like you come an hour before your dinner. Tell her you want two slices. Please put them away on a plate somewhere.
Hide that for me, please.
So that you have the excuse to buy one of the great bottles of Sauternes that they have.
Mm-hmm. That's a small restaurant. You need to plan if you're going to go there.
It's a small restaurant that is often not open because they base their work schedule on their children's school schedule.
Okay.
When the kids are off school, the restaurant's not open.
Mm-hmm. And, well, we stay at Le Cep there, which is a wonderful, you know, hotel and so easy to... I mean, there are so many things to do in Beaune.
It's a perfectly scaled little walking town.
It really is. And there is a lot of walking. A lot of the streets are closed to traffic. And, you know, you can... There's antiques and old bookshops and cookbook shops and... one of my favorite cheese shops is in Beaune. I'm not sure what the name of it is, but it really doesn't matter because it's right in the center square.
It's the one cheese shop on the Place Carnot.
It's Place Carnot. And also the other thing about going to Beaune is going to the hospice and seeing the architecture of this, you know, building. I guess it's from the 1200s. I'm not positive, but it's just an amazing building architecturally. And there are beautiful churches in town. I mean, there's so much to do in Beaune.
You know, there's all the different villages we talk about as growing the wine. A lot of them have little restaurants. There's one in Gevrey-Chambertin that we both have had great affection for called Chez Guy and Family, which is funny because it used to be just Chez Guy, but now the whole family is working there.
That's good.
And they keep an excellent cellar, and they do a couple of dishes, one in particular, a long braised beef cheeks, braised 12 hours in Gevrey-Chambertin wine.
Seems like a good idea.
And the lees, and yeah, that's super satisfying stuff. Not exactly summer cooking.
No.
People often go on vacation. One thing I would say about Burgundy is, even though the weather's pleasant in the summertime, the traditional cooking is maybe not what you want in the summertime as much. So mm-hmm. if you're thinking a spring trip, I think that's exactly, you catch those morels and you get the first products of the season and it's still cool enough at night that you want the richer cooking that the region's famous for.
Yeah, I remember having a snail dish there that had a lot of tomato in it, and it was just tomato and garlic.
Yeah,
it was so good and just brilliant. And you could sense the extra virgin olive oil that was in the dish as well. And it was really very, very good. That restaurant is nice because that village is tiny. It's very sweet to go there, and they have a little bit of outdoor seating there as well. So on a nice day, it is nice to sit outside.
One or two other travel notes about that area. It is very easy to take a train to Dijon, which is close by, and to rent a car there.
From Paris.
And to rent a car there and drive right down into Burgundy and head on down to Beaujolais and Lyon. That's a would be pretty interesting food and wine trip for sure. from those regions. And maybe you have your last meal in that region at Beaucuse, as you suggested.
Right. Head to Lyon, and there's many other places to eat there as well. So
Lyon has so many 1- and 2-star restaurants. That's one of the, mm-hmm. you know, we often find best values in 1 stars that are really trying to be, to get that second note of acclaim. That's, in general, that's a very good sort of strategy when you're in France and you're not in the very biggest cities. If you find a 1-star, they're probably killing themselves to try to get that second.
Mm-hmm.
And you often get your best values in dining and in effort, that's on the service side.
And a little different from the American outlook at lunch. I think we tend to feed ourselves at lunch, and there's not a lot of the pleasure in dining at lunch. I love to eat lunch in France. It's just such a pleasure, and they know how to do it. I mean, it's just done so well. So
yeah, lunch is entertainment and not as fuel.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
If you want to be casual in Lyon, there are so many different bouchons. Bouchon is a word for a cork. And there's so many places that are, you know, little tiny bistros that they'll have 3-4 dishes, and that's the menu for the day. And they have, you know, a handful of wines from growers that they know, and they're not any kind of money at all. And you can bounce from one to the next in the old quarter.
It's a good way to go.
You know, you mentioned staying at the Hotel Le Cep, L-E, second word, C-E-P, Cep, like the mushroom. Which is three townhouses from the 1600s and 1700s strung together in the middle of Beaune, which is super cute and interesting. And I think that there's 7 different levels of floors when you have to go walking along the different to connect the houses. But that's a fantastic place to stay and easy walking around Beaune. If you're staying in the Beaujolais, there is a great old castle, Chateau de Pizay, that I believe it's P-I-Z-A-Y.
That's right.
Very beautiful place, mm-hmm. And that has great grounds if the weather is nice.
The grounds are amazing. They have all this trimmed topiary. The grounds are great. Gorgeous.
And the things you want to organize in advance is visit to wine growers. I mean, hotels can do it for you, but visits to wine growers, you can contact them directly. Just do it respectfully. You can find them on the web pretty easily and send emails. Just be on time. And be gracious about it, and for goodness sake, if you can have a little bit of French, it helps a lot. And don't neglect wine growers all along the route, not just the famous places in the Côte d'Or or near Beaune, but if you're heading down through Beaujolais, it's great to visit and see what different growers are doing in different places.
Is it possible to stop in, or they absolutely need to make an appointment?
It's much better if places. The funny little thing I'll tell people is that if they're wide open for visitors, they probably don't make the best wine.
Okay. All right.
If you have to organize in advance, it's probably because the quantities are small and the demand is high, and they're maybe a little more serious about it, and they're not in the visitor business, they're in the wine business.
There you go.
Well, it's always short when we're talking about Burgundy. Cindy, any closing notes?
I strongly suggest going there, and if you have the opportunity, it's a beautiful region, and there's so much to do. I know that the autoroute sort of passed by Burgundy, I guess in the 70s, and it's really kind of changed the landscape a little bit, and you're going to have to search it out a bit. There's certainly great roads, and the roads are back roads, and it's a gorgeous drive, and it's just a beautiful part of the country.
Spend the time, exercise in advance, because you're going to eat and drink really well.
There you go.
That's it for Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. Thanks for coming to Burgundy with us.